in three ways. I'm going to be speaking to a historical overview of the apparatus of repression, the evolution of it in this country. And Natsu is going to address matters of law with an emphasis, I suppose, on the Patriot Act, but not exclusively focusing on the Patriot Act, because it's not the only game in town and not necessarily even the worst. And then Frank's going to deal with the coordinative aspects of the repression, sort of the evolution of that and where we find ourselves now. So we've been asked to shorten the presentations a little bit as well. So if I start to sound like an auctioneer, that's why. There's a lot more information I'm going to be able to actually lay out, but a lot of things will probably come out in the interchange. I think that probably with regard to the state apparatus of repression, the thing to be understood most clearly is that it is not new. It has been with us. For you can almost take your pick, throw a dart at a board, and pick a year in American history. Certainly, back into the COINTELPRO era of the 1960s, early 1970s, you had a full bore program of political repression mounted by the federal government, but it had antecedents that date back to the Palmer Raids period, the end of World War I, slacker raids that preceded that in 1917. So that framing, which was pretty much at the advent of what was then called the Bureau of Investigation, but actually there's a precursor to the Bureau of Investigation that runs back to the Civil War and actually gets its legs and begins to run, becomes the template for the techniques of repression that are going to be applied forever after. Now they've evolved them, they've refined them, they're more sophisticated in a lot of ways now than they were then, but the actual techniques that are employed to neutralize those who are considered from the perspective of those in power to be politically objectionable really came out with a prefiguration of Ronald Reagan's privatization of government functions from the 1980s that was occurring in the United States in the second half of the 1860s, when the investigative aspect for judicial enforcement the United States of America was contracted out to private agency. That would be the Pinkertons. Now, I want to run you through a few cases, but I want to talk about the structural interlock, which you still see today. The Pinkertons, as a private enterprise, was retained by the federal government to fulfill the investigative functions of the government, whatever those might be, on the one hand, but that was insufficient to allow it to be sufficient. Well, it wasn't profitable enough on that basis to function as a private sector business enterprise. It wasn't simply serving the government, and it wasn't your average factory worker or railroad section gang worker or field worker, obviously, who was paying for the services of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. While they were working on federal retainer, they were simultaneously working for the railroads, the steel mills, the coal mine interests, and so forth. So you had this sort of state corporate repressive interlock right from the very get-go. The interests were synonymous, and it really takes the form of that notion that what's good for General Motors is going to be good for the country. So they would be serving the federal interest by serving the interests of General Motors, and they would be serving the interests of General Motors by serving the interests of the federal government, and it was pretty much that clean. And it paved the way for a lot of things to happen. But mainly, what you have to understand, the mission from both or all three sides of the equation that's involved here, the mission of the repressive entity was to maintain order. They talk about law and order. Law serves order, that's the function of law, but this is the actual sharp end of the stick by which order is maintained. And the order is this: there is a place for everything in this society, there is a place for everyone in this society. An entity like the Pinkertons, or what becomes the Bureau of Investigation, or the FBI, and all the interlocking local and state level agencies, their function is to make sure that everyone and everything stays in its assigned place. The one offense you can commit that will really warrant interest in the area that we're talking about is to attempt to change the place. Not so much of things, but of persons. And that could be true individually, but it's more true in terms of group interests, okay? So groups are assigned their place. And we can talk about that, but I think probably that's an area wide of what I have time to discuss right now. We can come back to it, what this business of place is about, if you want. But let me run through a few of those early cases that emerged in the 1870s and the manner by which they were solved. You have a group in southern Indiana, which is called the Reno Gang. Now, this is not an explicitly political entity, but what this entity was doing as a criminal enterprise was expropriating the assets of railroads. They invented train robbery. Okay, that's contradicting. Yeah, contradicting the interests of the railroad magnates, obviously, but it's also contradicting the interests of the state, because the state sees an interest in transcontinental laying of track and the communications ability, shipping ability, and so forth that arises from that. Now, the Reno's activities, not everybody wants to have the Reno's over to dinner in southern Indiana, you understand, but basically there is a social affirmation of what they're doing, because in order to get the rights of way for the railroads, the government is using power of eminent domain to dispossess individual landowners and run a track across it, okay? So this idea, this group of guys coming out of southern Indiana, kind of getting even with the railroads, very popular. They call in the Pinkertons to resolve that. They're unable to do it because of the popularity of these people. They're not exactly guerrillas, but it's the same principle that Mao articulated. Okay, the people become the sea in which the Reno Gang swims. Consequently, by detective services, the Pinkertons can get nowhere. Ultimately, they catch one of the guys. This becomes instructive. Has to do with interrogation and creation of snitches, but also sending messages and the use of what Frank Kitson, a British counterinsurgency specialist of the 20th century, is going to call creation of pseudo-gangs to serve government interests. That is, creation of entities that don't otherwise exist. What are their criminal enterprises or political enterprises? They'll make them up out of whole cloth to serve various purposes. Well, they catch one of these guys. They got him locked up in a cell. Okay, he's not talking. That night, a lynch mob forms, comes down, overpowers the jailer, hauls him out of his cell down to an oak tree at the edge of town, announcing he's going to be hanged immediately if he doesn't divulge the whereabouts of other members of the gang, which he does, thereupon is hanged. Okay, they take the information, they grab two more of them, take them to jail cell where they're under lock and key. They're not talking, but that night a lynch mob forms, comes down, overpowers the turnkey, takes them out to the same oak tree, informs them, same thing. That's how they roll up the gang. There's something really wrong with the picture if you think about it. These guys can't be caught because of the great degree of popularity evident for them in southern Indiana. Why is a lynch mob forming? Very nearly admitted late in his life in his memoirs by Alan Pinkerton that these were Pinkerton operatives, okay, impersonating a lynch mob for purposes of rolling up the case, okay? Now, you got summary justice being dispensed. Obviously, the Renos are not going to continue their activities if they've been lynched, and they were very nearly all lynched before it was over, okay? But creating a false impression as to public sentiment and several other political vectors enter into this. So this is one technique that you'll find being used certainly right up into the mid-1960s with the sort of use of the Ku Klux Klan as a surrogate against the civil rights movement in the southern states. But it hasn't really outlived its usefulness now. But I'd say they establish a template there for operational method that allows them to retire a case in their mind satisfactory that has absolutely nothing to do with law enforcement. In fact, is flagrantly illegal, but very effective. And the object of these kinds of operations hasn't got to do with law enforcement, and that's stated straightforwardly by people who run FBI counterintelligence in the 1970s, said success is measured in this area by neutralization of the target. If neutralization happens to be achieved by putting someone in a cell, so be it, but that's not particularly important to us. The point is to make them stop doing what it is that caused them to be targeted. Now, think about that in terms of political objectionability. Second case I'd like to mention would be that of the James Younger Gang, Clay County, Missouri, a little bit after the Reno Gang, okay? James's are usually credited with inventing train robbery. They weren't. The Renos were first. That's what happened to the Renos. How they solved the Jesse James case is basically pay a guy, Bob Ford, $10,000 to go in and shoot him in the back of the head at point blank range. So you got essentially assassination. Now that's a successful solution to the case. That solved the James Younger case. They got Jesse James killed. You can think Jesse James is a great guy out of Americana, legend, or you can think he was a thug. It doesn't really matter. The operational technique is what is at issue. That's how they resolved the case. You know, consider that in terms of, say, the Hampton Clark assassinations, Black Panther leaders in Chicago in 1969, and you'll see that what was established as a model in what was Jesse James, 1878? Well, 1969, they're still carrying out exactly the same operational technique for exactly the same purpose, although more specifically on political grounds in 1969 than it was in Clay County. But you also have to understand the James Younger operation was a very political operation as well, in its way. Third one comes from the 1880s, has to do with the Molly Maguires, which is a militant labor organization in Pennsylvania coal fields. I won't go all into the background on the Mollies. I see people nodding their heads. Okay, the way they resolved that one was to bring in a Pinkerton operative who, they were all Irish immigrants. Most of them were refugees, political refugees, Fabians and so forth from Ireland that were wanted by the Brits. Well, they got an Irish Pinkerton agent by the name of McParlin to infiltrate, as you know, his cover was that he was also a political fugitive from Ireland, had been involved in Fabian activities and so forth. They had him set up pretty well. He managed to ingratiate himself with the leadership of the Molly Maguires, began to propose that they take particular actions that they probably would not otherwise have taken, okay, involving dynamite and closing mine shafts, a couple of assassinations of managerial staff of the mine owners and so forth. The big operation that they were going to pull off, he had provided the dynamite, the plan, most of the rest of the logistics and so forth, and then when they showed up to carry out the bombing, police, mine police, were waiting for them. You had this mass hanging ultimately in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, of the entire Molly Maguire leadership. Okay, the star witness against him was a guy who had proposed the plan in the first place and made it possible to carry it out. So you have infiltration for intelligence gathering purposes, but you have something going way beyond intelligence gathering, which is the functioning of this infiltrator as an agent provocateur. Now, provocateurs will function in this way. They will also function in a highly disruptive way, rather than furthering operations of a criminal sort, as is defined by statutory code. They may try to prevent the organization from doing anything by spreading rumors within it, badjacking individuals and so forth. But all of this had been worked out in terms of the labor policing activities of the Pinkerton Detective Agency by 1890. And you got a sort of a disruption that occurs, a discontinuity in the history, where you have this big labor battle up north of here a bit. And it was kind of negative publicity, so the government severed its relationship with the Pinkerton Agency, then had to create its own Bureau of Investigation attached to the Justice Department. But when you're going to start up an investigative operation from zero, who are you going to get to staff it? Well, obviously, they went to the Pinkerton Agency and hired a bunch of Pinkertons, okay, to come on the federal payroll. So you've got this sort of crossover effect that's occurring. I mean, the Pinkertons' continuity in terms of the manpower that were involved, the expertise involved, it's not disrupted at all. Same people. But that actually becomes a situation that works in reverse, and I expect Frank will get to this in the end, is that they began to train people within the federal domain for particular types of activity that were restricted by statute in terms of formal civil authority engaging in it, and then they would retire these guys early or otherwise pave the way for them to go into the industrial police force. So you've got basically a structural interlock between the FBI and these private police forces that are out there at the present time. And I don't know how many people are aware of it, but there's a lot more private cops out there on the street than there are public employed police. And they're not constrained even nominally to conform to rules of legality. You know, one sector, rather than just take a pretty sensational example to make the point, you got bounty hunters who are often trained in police agencies for the line of work that they go in. Bounty hunters can kick in your door. They require no warrant, okay? use all due armed force to ensure that you will come with them. That's their job. But they're not constrained to obey any of the protections, safeguards, and so forth that at least nominally apply to the police. It's just wide open. Well, among other things, the industrial police forces and the private security agencies and so forth have been able to gather on a risk-free basis kinds of intelligence that are statutorily prohibited with regard to the FBI or local red squads or so forth. They do it anyway, but they can have these guys that they've trained and placed in positions out there in cooperating agencies do it on a nominally private basis, but also very consistently, and have a much broader intelligence gathering net. They also pinpoint targets, okay? But in the process of creating that structure where you got a private-public interlock in terms of intelligence gathering and repression, which is beginning to emerge by the 1920s, and J. Edgar Hoover, who becomes the 50-year director of the FBI, specialized in this and also actually got himself appointed as a Naval Reserve officer so that he could have a position within naval intelligence. So he's got military intelligence feeding him, he's got industrial intelligence operations feeding him, and he begins to proliferate these connections with the political squads, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, so forth. So you've got a localized intelligence gathering capacity, but also an operational capacity, a strike capacity, that they run the kinds of things that were developed by the Pinkertons in a much more broad-based and efficient manner, ever more efficient, ever more intelligence, knowledge being power. They collect data on people so they can select targets fairly surgically after a period of time. And as with the Hampton Clark case, which was mentioned a while ago, these were not FBI personnel per se that carried out the assassinations. They were local police, a special squad of state's attorney's police, okay, who were operating basically under command and control of the FBI. The FBI provided them the intelligence information necessary to carry out the raid, provided them a pretext, withdrew that when it turned out to not be true, but kept their hands clean, or they had a Chinese wall, as it's called, built up that lasted for about 10 years against intensive investigation in the aftermath of that. So you got the emergence of a centralized hub of priority setting, command and control, and intelligence data gathering. Also, the analysis of this intelligence data that's collected and fed back out then to various sectors, whether it be local police, state police agencies, or private police agencies. The FBI is filtering the information on a continuous basis and putting it back out, who they should be paying attention to, and so on. Says I got 2 minutes left. By the time you get to the end of the COINTELPRO era, and COINTELPRO, for those who don't know, is an acronym. It was actually a cryptonym because it's a secret operation. Secret because it was understood to be illegal at the time. That runs from like 1956 to 1971 when it was ostensibly terminated. In that period, you see the full inventory of techniques that are still being applied, sort of laid out in a continuum of order. And the order which this continuum applies, they'll start with, I guess you could have to say, the least objectionable or the least intensive or the least extreme method in order to neutralize their political targets. And if that doesn't work, they move to the next. And if that doesn't work, they move to the next, to the point where you end up with, like Hampton and Clark, with assassination being the means. That begins with a pretty much continuous tone of disinformation, and that operates at a couple levels, okay? At one level, it's continuous feed into mass media sources. There was a point when the FBI had something like 450 what they call collaborating or friendly journalists who would literally sign their byline to copy that was written in the basement of the FBI building and presented as news, okay? So that's for general public consumption, but they also put infiltrators, people to spread rumors and disinformation, inside the organizations that are targeted. And that's a provocateur function, but at a fairly low level. And if they can discredit individuals that they define as being the key organizers of the targeted groups or the groups themselves, prevent them from recruiting or having resonance with the public, that can be the neutralization. And if that works, they may stop. If that doesn't work, they go to a higher level where they will take more proactive steps within the organizations or within communities to get people literally targeted for perhaps physical abuse and so forth. That might deter people. They will pass out disinformation about your personal life. Did you know that your girlfriend was sleeping with that guy there? Yeah. Well, I didn't figure you knew, but I saw the other night the evidence that was true. Okay, and you can trust me because, well, I'm just got your well-being at heart. This kind of nonsense. You, on the other hand, were out there soliciting funds for our organization the other day. I know that you took down a couple $100 because I put $100 in a can just to see what would happen. And you only turned in 50. So you pocketing the difference. So spread this kind of suspicion, dissension, ultimately within organizations to cause them to unravel. Potentially could be criminal offense as well. Graduate from that, and actually usually is coupled, have things like pretext arrest. You have a case in 1967, that's going to take me another couple minutes, okay? 1967 in Philadelphia, having to do with the Revolutionary Action Movement, where the technique was to enter into a collaborative relation with the Red Squad of the Philadelphia Police Department, and basically it was just to arrest known members of the Revolutionary Action Movement. RAM members were arrested every time they set foot on the street for any possible pretext, absolutely no hope of conviction. They never intended to take this stuff to trial. The idea was to get people, lock them up, make them make bail, mount a legal defense, or at least retain an attorney, all of which costs money, and as soon as they walk out on bail, arrest them for something else and put them right back in. They got to make bail again, okay. They got to have a lawyer retained for that one too. Now they walk out, bust them again. And basically they dissolved an organization. They were real proud of it. It was an extra legal utilization of the legal system. But in more serious cases where they got a higher profile individual target, sometimes a group target, they'll go actually try to make the case. And then you end up with an extra legal utilization of the judicial system that can result in actual penal time. Okay, they'll fabricate evidence, they'll withhold exculpatory evidence, they'll introduce their snitches, they'll deny their snitches to be the key witnesses against people. Got cases which are fairly famous of this having been used during the COINTELPRO period. In New York, for example, you got a member of the Panther 21, one of the leaders of Black Panther chapter in New York City by the name of Daruba Bin Wahad, that ended up spending 19 years in maximum security in New York State, okay, for having attempted to murder police officers. As they said, the FBI ballistics lab had determined that the weapon that was supposedly the key piece of evidence against him, on the one hand, was not the weapon used in the shooting, okay, and then you got this case of a key witness, Pauline Johnson, being held for almost 2 years against, originally it was probably with her permission, but ultimately against her will, and told she was never going to be released unless she entered firsthand information or supposed eyewitness information that would confirm the case. So you got both of those factors in that particular New York case, and there's several others that I could go into. You got Geronimo G. Giaga out in California that it ended up doing 27 years, okay, on the basis of snitch testimony, and the guy actually sat on a stand and denied that he was a snitch, okay, and the FBI knew it was impossible for him to committed the act for which he was convicted, and they'd set him up to be convicted because they had, in process of electronic surveillance, okay, identified him as being present at a Black Panther Central Committee meeting in Oakland, California, when the murder for which he was convicted was committed in Santa Monica at the same time. Now that's 350 miles away, and denied that they had surveilled, okay, when that was originally put up on appeal that the surveillance would disclose this, they denied that they had been engaged in the electronic surveillance. Then when it came out in 1975, the church committee hearings, that they had in fact been engaged in electronic surveillance, they said, oops, oh, we misspoke. And the judge ordered them to provide the phone tap logs for the particular period that would either confirm or deny Pratt's story. That's Geronimo G. Giaga. And they purported to have lost the phone logs for that particular 2 week period of time. And he was left in prison. Now he spent 8.5 years in solitary as a result of this, and it was a conviction that was to the knowledge of the people who put him in prison as bogus as a $3 bill. Pseudo gangs figure into the next level, which is to foment actual violence to get people assassinated. You got a famous case of that in Los Angeles with creation of the so-called US Panther War, where they're putting out, the FBI is putting out derogatory cartoons of both sides in the style of the literature that they produce in order to take what they referred to as two violence-prone groups and set them at odds. Their body count on that was 6 dead Panthers, up to the point where, as in Hampton and Clark, when all else fails, they do it themselves. So you've got this continuum that runs from just whispering campaigns and misreporting in the press up through actual political assassination as part of the inventory of what it is they, by mandate, were supposed to have stopped as of 1971, when a formal termination of COINTELPRO was ordered for reasons we'll go into later. My own organization, the American Indian Movement, was hit more comprehensively and intensively in South Dakota 3 years after that than the Black Panthers were hit during the period of the height of the COINTELPRO repression, which may give you some indication of how much stoppage they actually did. But anybody with questions beyond that might want to talk to some people who are survivors of Waco or Ruby Ridge, because it's not just, it usually is, but not just what might be termed left dissident formations that are targeted and hit. Okay, it's anybody that threatens the stability of the order of things as it's encountered. And I've already talked too long, so now I'm going to stop.
Okay, thanks.
If not to, stay tuned.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's good to see everybody out here. I want to talk mostly about some of the new legislation and some of the new executive actions that have not been passed by Congress, and the effect that... Pardon? Okay, I'll try.
There's no PA at all.
The mic's just for recording purposes.
Okay, wave at the back if you can't hear, okay? Okay, I'm Natsu Saito. I teach at Georgia State's Law School in Atlanta, and I do work in the areas of international law and human rights. I want to talk about some of the specifics of the USA Patriot Act and some of the new other legislation and the executive action that has come about in the last few months, because I think that they have serious consequences for those of us who are engaged in political activities. But I really, really think it's important to put this into the kind of context that Ward was talking about and to realize that none of this is new. They didn't just think of this. They were waiting to bring out these specifics of this legislation and these actions. But beyond that, it is completely consistent with everything that the United States government has done since the moment of its inception to try to foster the particular kind of social order and political order that we have. And this is true both in the context of domestic law and international law. I think that a lot of us are here tonight because we're upset about both the way in which this new repressive domestic legislation is coming down in the context of the post-September 11th U.S. foreign policy actions. And I think we have to note that, number one, these are integrally related, right? We can't separate these out, domestic repression from U.S. foreign policy. And in both those contexts, we have this very important context in history that we see them both coming out of, right? We can't look at U.S. foreign policy in isolation. I'm very pleased that there's been mobilization with respect to sort of an anti-war effort in the last couple of months. But the foreign policy that the United States is engaging in now is a continuation of its foreign policy, as I said, from its inception, but certainly, you know, directly, clearly for the last 10 years, right? And even though I'm, of course, pleased to see people mobilizing at this point, I find it disturbing, too, that we're mobilizing now. You know, it looks suspiciously like when U.S. lives are directly at stake and when those of us who engage in political activities at home are under more severe constrictions. You know, if we really cared about these actions, we would have been protesting the U.S. policies in Iraq over the past 10 years that have caused well over 500,000 Iraqi children to die. you know, we would be protesting U.S. policies with respect to the suppression of the Palestinians, and on and on and on, because this is the background. We can't wait until all of a sudden it's, you know, U.S. lives at stake to get involved in that. And in that context, it sort of, in looking at trying to get U.S. foreign policy to comply with international law, we can't separate that out from domestic policy and domestic repression. A lot of what Ward was talking about in terms of COINTELPRO and these kinds of governmental activities that do go back, they were explicitly aimed at suppressing political dissent and political organization. They're explicitly directed at groups, particularly that have been struggling for racial and economic justice. And this is all directly tied into both U.S. foreign policy and the history of domestic policy, right? We can't look at globalization now and protest that without realizing that globalization goes back at least as far as the Portuguese slave trade on the west coast of Africa, right? We have to look at all of these things as part of this continuation. And the current U.S. refusal to comply with international law, the kind, you know, the current version of it, and our refusal to sign on to human rights treaties, our refusal to comply with customary international law with respect to war and the treatment of political dissenters and treatment of prisoners, all that. A lot of this dates directly back to the post-World War II era, in which, after the formation of the United Nations, with its advocacy of racial, social, religious, other kinds of equality, the United States government, this was an era of explicit apartheid in America, right? This was when we had Jim Crow laws. A lot of the opposition to U.S. participation in human rights treaties had to do with the determination that the international community was not going to make us dismantle segregation here. And so, to the extent that you care about U.S. foreign policy, you have to also care about U.S. domestic policy. And to me, you know, people who say that they cared about international human rights but didn't care about segregation at home are being hypocrites. And in the same way, we have to look. There are extremely repressive domestic measures being implemented now, but there's a direct history of that. But there's also, we cannot complain about the fact that political activists are being targeted and being given 20 and 30 year sentences when we sit around and we allow young African-American men to be sent away for life for a grand total of $110 worth of drugs or two shoplifting charges, right? We can't do that. That is as political a struggle as any of this is. And I have to sort of put all this in that context, because otherwise I think it's very self-serving for us to be protecting our own very narrow interests with respect to this new legislation. As we said, a lot of this current legislation dates directly back to the COINTELPRO era and the history of these same agencies, the, quote, intelligence agencies that are being given expanded criminal enforcement powers and intelligence powers. And a lot of what's happening right now is the rollback of restrictions that were put into place as a consequence of the exposure of these blatantly illegal activities in the 50s, 60s, and 70s by, among other things, the Senate Select Committee to Study Government Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, usually known as the Church Committee. And the Church Committee reports are out there. They're available. You can go to the library. You can find out what the United States Senate said that the FBI and the CIA were doing.
Speak louder, please.
I don't know. I'll try. What the Church Committee documented was this long range of the kinds of activities that Ward was talking about, in terms of repression of political dissent and activities. And one of the things that happened, though, directly after that, even though supposedly some of this was being rolled back, was in 1978, something was passed called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that set up Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is FISA, right? That's the acronym. And FISA courts were set up, which allowed for secret operations in intelligence matters. And so we have, even though there was a supposed restriction on the activities of intelligence agencies, we have had, since 1978, the ability of these secret courts to hear evidence and to issue warrants with respect to intelligence matters. And one of the really important things about the new legislation is that it merges much more blatantly than had officially been happening before, criminal investigations and intelligence operations. One of the big myths about that I'm sure you are aware of currently is that what's being done now is a matter of security and safety, and that it is part of fighting crime, right? This has always been the way it's been pitched. It's been pitched since early abolitionists were deemed supporters of sedition and rebellion, right? It goes from that period all the way up through any kinds of political dissent have been labeled as criminal. Well, now we have the blurring of the line between criminal and intelligence investigations. We also have dramatically limited judicial oversight, so that government agencies are much freer to officially act than they were before. And we have the elimination of any barriers of intergovernmental information sharing. So it's not like any of this stuff wasn't happening before, right? We know that it was, but it wasn't necessarily legal before. And one of the big differences is, now that it's legal, it means it can be used against people in criminal courts, right? So before, if they got information on you illegally, they might use it against you surreptitiously, but it didn't mean that they could convict you on the basis of it. And that's a big difference. Let me just talk about some of the specific provisions of the law, and we can go into more detail if you want later. One is that a really important piece of the new law is that it broadens the definition of foreign intelligence information. Okay, this is sort of a term of law, right? Foreign intelligence information. It now encompasses any information, whether or not it pertains to a U.S. person. It used to be restricted to when it dealt with U.S. citizens or residents, but it's no longer restricted, relating to the ability of the U.S. to protect against hostile acts of foreign powers or their agents, or regarding a foreign power that relates to the national defense, security, or conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States. Okay? It used to say necessary to, but now it just says relates to. So any information that has anything to do with any other country and relates to the conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States is foreign intelligence information. Okay, then the question is, what do we do with this, right? Now the federal rules of evidence have been changed so that any foreign intelligence information which is obtained from a grand jury can be shared with other persons, right? And I'm sure you're familiar a little bit at least with how grand juries work, but what's important about them is that you don't have the normal protections of criminal evidence law rules, or of being able to not having to testify. You can, you know, you've seen people plead the Fifth or claim the Fifth Amendment in the context of grand juries. You don't have to give information that's directly incriminating of yourself to a grand jury, but you have to give information about anybody else that they ask you about, right? Otherwise, you're in jail for contempt. And so now this information can be obtained from anybody else besides you, right, and then used against those persons in criminal convictions, and it can be shared with any other agencies, as long as it's in this really broad definition of foreign intelligence information. Any of this kind of information that comes from wiretaps or other kinds of surveillance can be disclosed to any federal law enforcement or intelligence agencies. FISA-authorized searches have been expanded. You've heard, I'm sure, about these, what they call sneak and peek warrants or black bag jobs, where they can get a warrant where they don't have to tell you about it, and they can come into your house and search your house, your computers, whatever. And the only time you might hear about it is if they actually introduce this evidence against you in a court of law. They never actually have to tell you about it. The FBI can get orders from a FISA court or from any federal magistrate requiring any person or business to produce any books, records, documents, or items merely upon certification that it seeks them for foreign intelligence information purposes. So if an FBI agent goes and says, with that broad definition of foreign intelligence information, that it certifies to a federal magistrate anywhere in the country or a FISA judge That's why they want it. The judge has no discretion. The judge has to issue the warrant. The only caveat on that is that with respect to U.S. persons, it can't be done solely because of First Amendment-protected activity. In other words, they can't only do it because they don't like your speech or your associations, but they can also do it because they don't like those things. There's telephone and internet monitoring that I'm sure you've heard about. They can theoretically get to-from information on the internet stuff, right? But they say they don't have the technology now to only get the to-from information, so they're just not going to read the text. And they're roving wiretaps so that the wiretap no longer goes with the telephone line. The wiretap follows you to whatever phone you use. What that means is that it doesn't literally physically follow you, but they have permission to tap any phone that you use, right? So you go to your friend's house and make calls from your friend's house. They don't have to have a separate warrant for your friend's phone, right? This warrant will cover any of those phones that you use. What's interesting about this is that the Department of Justice sent the House and Senate Judiciary Committees letters asserting that they believe this to not only be constitutional, their theory is that the executive branch has inherent authority to engage in warrantless counterintelligence searches. So they're saying, we were nice enough to get you, Congress, to pass this, but we don't actually think there's any constitutional restrictions on any kind of warrantless counterintelligence services by the executive branch. That's the current administration's position on this. All of this information can be shared with the CIA. All of the restrictions on sharing information with the CIA that came in the wake of the Operation Chaos revelations of the Church Committee in the 70s have been rolled back. And you've heard, I'm sure, about these sunset provisions, but the sunset provisions are very specific. It only applies to some of it. They really don't provide any protection. Lots of other important things. Some of it has to do with the money laundering stuff is important. You know, you think, well, you know, we don't engage in money laundering, right? That's big time money stuff. But in fact, what they're doing is that allows them to trace funds of any kinds of organizations, right? And they've used this a lot in the immigration context, even before the passage of this act, where they have identified organizations as being subversive in some form. And then they've been deporting people on the basis of, you went to a Palestinian dinner dance and you gave a $25 check, and that organization, that was a fundraiser for this orphanage, and this orphanage is connected to this other group, and this other group is connected to this third group, and this third group is connected to Hamas, and therefore you gave money to a terrorist organization when you went to that dinner dance, and now you're deported. Okay, so that's, you know, when they talk about money laundering, they're talking about being able to follow the trail of your $5 check wherever they want to follow it. It's a lot easier to detain non-citizens in the long run, but that doesn't really seem to matter because they seem to be doing that at will anyway, which we'll talk about in a minute. Student privacy, they can get any records they want from any educational institution, and the institutions have been just voluntarily handing this stuff over left and right, so, you know, don't expect any privacy there. Let me just say, basically, just two more things. One is, I just want to point out that there's a new crime that they're calling domestic terrorism, right? Before September 11th, and again, this actually has nothing to do with September 11th, right? They had this stuff ready to roll, but it was very convenient. Before September 11th, the law prohibited international terrorism. It prohibited terrorism transcending national borders, and there was a federal terrorism crime. A lot of the more repressive domestic stuff came about since the 80s. There have been, you know, the Reagan administration introduced a lot of repressive legislation, and then in 1996 we had the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and there's been a lot of this stuff has been coming in bits and pieces anyway. So there was lots of law that if we're looking for law that the September 11th attacks violated, there was plenty of that law. But they've created a new crime that's domestic terrorism, and a person commits that crime if, within the United States, they engage in activity involving acts dangerous to human life that violate the laws of the U.S. or any state. Okay, so endanger human life, that could mean blocking an intersection, right? violate the, any of the laws of the United States or any state. So we now have federal jurisdiction over state criminal law violations. And appear intended to either intimidate or coerce a civilian population or influence the policy of a government, meaning including ours, right, by intimidation or coercion, or affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. So if you're trying to influence government policy and you endanger human life and you break any law at all, right, this is domestic terrorism. Not only somebody who engages in domestic terrorism, the government can then wiretap their homes, they can engage, you know, do all kinds of things. Well, one of the really two really important things is their provisions for harboring domestic terrorists, which means letting somebody who fits this definition sleep on your living room floor, and it means providing material support, which is any kind of money or any kind of support, right? There's dramatically expanded federal, state, local law enforcement cooperation and expanded powers of the CIA. The director of the CIA, rather than the attorney general, is now in charge of establishing priorities for gathering intelligence in the United States. This would appear to directly contravene the charter of the CIA, but nonetheless, there it is. Let me just say, you know, the other big pieces, of course, are that this is just that one law, right, which is one of a series of a lot of laws. The Executive Department has engaged in lots of other activities, the most dramatic being the detention of, as of November, at least 1,200 non-citizens, right? I mean, these people have just been disappeared, right? I mean, we talk about disappearances in Latin America. That's what's happening here, right? They stopped telling us how many when people started getting upset. But we know that, you know, they're detained. There still are thousands of people in detention. We don't know exactly who or where or why, and most of them have not been charged. Most of them are being held under very, very harsh security, you know, the kinds of conditions that are supposedly reserved for the most dangerous and violent convicted people, and these people are not convicted or even charged. There's this voluntary questioning of at least 5,000 young men of Middle Eastern origin. And what's happening is, I don't know, some of you may have seen, I saw some of them from the University of Michigan, some students being interviewed on TV, and they said they had gone in for this voluntary questioning, which of course they didn't think was actually voluntary. And they said the agents were asking them questions like, have you seen anybody engage in any criminal activity? And they said, no, right? And the guy said, you've never seen anybody underage drinking? Right? I mean, these are college students, right? And so then they go, well, yes, of course. Well, did you know that, you know, there's X and Y and Z, you know, penalties for perjury and for lying to a federal officer and blah, 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 which means, right, they're not going to prosecute these kids for perjury right now, but it means that they've got, you know, they can deport them whenever they want, they can force them to turn into informants whenever they want, right? And this is the kind of stuff that's going on with respect to these cases. Ashcroft has unilaterally thrown privileged attorney-client communication out the window between people, anybody who's detained, not convicted, but detained. And then, you know, of course, they've introduced this this military order for military tribunals. And then finally, they've really restricted the access we have to information through FOIA, through the Freedom of Information Act. Ashcroft has sent out a memo to all the heads of the federal agencies and departments that doesn't exactly, in so many words, say don't ever give out any information under FOIA anymore. But what it says is any information you give out, you know, these are very sensitive times, and any information you could give out could endanger the national security. And if you give out any information that endangers the national security, it's going to be your fault. But if you deny any request, we will back you up all the way. Okay, so there we are.
Right up in the front, and our next speaker is Frank Morales.
The Pentagon Incorporated and its myriad linkages with various law enforcement agencies under the heading of Operations Other Than War, which is a doctrinal euphemism adopted by the Pentagon over the last decade. Operations Other Than War has effectively declared war on America. And by that, what I'm getting at is that the symbiosis between the police and the military We've heard the expression, the militarization of the police. We could also see it in terms of the policization of the military. It is, for me, the kind of background for how we see the current stage of repression, which, again, is historically linked to the days of the founding, if we can use those terms, of this country. Although the Declaration of Independence makes clear, I think, what is the statement? Let me find it here. The Declaration of Independence stated as one of its grievances that the king had kept standing armies without the consent of the colonist legislatures and, quote, affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. I suggest to you that we are in a pre-revolutionary situation here in America right now. I think it's clear that the internal security needs of the elite, dating back to the Sedition Act in the 1790s, to War Plans White, which followed the Bolshevik revolution in the Soviet Union, 1919, which was a massive military intelligence directed surveillance disruption of radical movements during that period, right up to the period in the late 60s with the creation of Operation Garden Plot, which in essence is a contemporary militarized contingency plan. It's in action these days quite a lot for suppressing civil disturbance, to use the euphemism of the Pentagon. Operation Garden Plot was quite active recently during Los Angeles, where the dictates of the plan set in motion the movement of troops, the transference of military technology, and so on, right through to Seattle and various protests. Seattle, by the way, in terms of current euphemisms, being designated a terrorist event in order to facilitate, the paying of bills, and so on. I think we need to see this, obsession with internal security on the part of the elite as simply part of the nature of counterinsurgency and revolutionary struggle in this country. It's nothing new. To the extent that people are out struggling around basic human rights, food, shelter, and clothing, justice, and so on, we will encounter, it stands to reason, a counterinsurgency effort on the part of the corporate elite and its militarized police and military apparatus. I think it's important for us to recognize that the generals who are currently taking a hands-on approach to the needs of the corporations in suppressing dissent in America. For instance, just jump to this one thing. Recently in New York City here, we had appointed the head of the anti-terrorism office here in New York, General Labuti, who is former head of the in the area of Korea. The Marine Command there is now heading up the anti-terrorism unit here in New York, while David Cohen heads up the intelligence apparatus here in New York City, former head director of operations for the Central Intelligence Agency, who, while he was there, received a bad rap from people within the intelligence so-called community as well, for having a penchant for fabricating intelligence in order to sanction certain policy. So I think that we can look forward to the creation of such so-called intelligence in order to facilitate the kinds of apparatus, the kind of repression that we've come to see. The point that I want to make is that whereas now I can point to developments like the Regional Information Sharing System or the RIS network, which is a current surveillance intelligence gathering apparatus set up through the Justice Department with various linkages to the CIA, FBI, and so on, is part of a long history of information gathering on the part of those who would, you know, seek to maintain control, and it's sort of the you know, the obscene inequalities that we're forced to live with. So these things are nothing new. But what is new, I think, is the overt counterinsurgency, if you will, the overt nature of calling for things like military tribunals, the stationing of military personnel in domestic law enforcement, you know, the training of National Guard to utilize electromagnetic dispersal weapons on civilian protesters. So it's an overt development that causes some of us, you know, a bit of some pause, but I think that we need to see that the handwriting is on the wall for this elite. And the handwriting is on the wall for the kinds of obscene policies that, you know, we've seen for so many years, you know, in this country, around the world, that poor people of color have experienced every day. The counterinsurgency of the drug war, the counterinsurgency of displacement and homelessness. These are all part and parcel of the kinds of policies that this government has, you know, has stood for so many years now. So the overt nature of it, it's like, whoa, these people are really out, you know, out to, you know, control, you know, put us where they think we belong. To me, signals that we are at a period now when we need to come straight out. We need to be even more bold in terms of the need and the desire for revolution in this country, for the need and the desire to, you know, take the weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of these people who are in control and out of control. So I suggest that we see these developments not as, as something that should make us feel paranoid, but as quite understandable. As Palestinians say, this is the paranoia of the thief. What we see right now is an attempt to limit our democratic space in terms of protest. I mean, as early as 1975, the Trilateral Commission, in its final reports, was in the Crisis of Democracy. It's a NYU Press. It's still available. You can find it. State quite clearly, Samuel Huntington, the author, who was at the WEF, the conference here recently, along with Brzezinski, leading the workshop on future trends, stated at that time in this report that there are potentially desirable limits to the indefinite extension of political democracy. I mean, this is 75. So we had the formation of Operation Garden Plot, which is Army-directed contingency plan, which has now been, you know, shuttled out to various National Guard and police units around the country, which goes into detail about, you know, how to enact martial rule as opposed to martial law. It's eminently more workable. How to deal with, you know, portable detention centers, and how to tag people, and how to do this. I mean, it gets into the minutia of a police state. So I think that, you know, we now have a task of educating the public to, you know, particularly delineate the kinds of things that are taking place all around us, to be bold about it, to utilize whatever means we can to horizontally organize. And by that I mean is not always to jump to the kind of let's meet them in the schoolyard the next time they have a meeting and go bump up against you know, their apparatus. I think we need to look horizontally, go into the communities and establish bases in the communities, seize the storefronts, seize the buildings. My background is squatting. I think we need to begin to dig deep into the communities, okay? Not to set ourselves up to be knocked down. The other thing that I want to say is that there is room for clandestinity. Some people suggest that, you know, we need to have the ability to wage a certain kind of combat. Now, I'm not here suggesting violence, But I do think that it would be unwise for us to assume that we can do everything in a kind of transparency, you know, that allows for a certain amount of infiltration, disruption, and so forth. I think we need to be aware of the kinds of sleazy things that these people are capable of. But, you know, these are low IQ individuals. I mean, I think you can psych that stuff out, you know? I mean, I remember Tommy the Traveler back in 1968 would come to our meetings, and people knew him, you know? He sat around, smoked pot and the whole thing. He seemed like one of us. One day he took me and a few of us out into the woods and showed us a whole Volkswagen full of dynamite and suggested that we go blow up our OTC. Mind you, there were some people that were into doing those kind of things. This was a recruitment, army recruitment thing that used to be on the various campuses. He was able to convince a couple of freshmen to do it, and we were in court, and suddenly Tommy, who we all knew as part of our meet group and so on and so forth, walks in with the FBI in a suit and all that, and was an agent provocateur. I had never heard the term at this point. I was young. Agent provocateur, what's that? You mean they actually pay people to come and set you up in this way and do this kind of thing? Well, I was naive. So, you know, we need to obviously disabuse ourselves of those kinds of beliefs. This is where it is right now. I think that the stakes from the point of view of the elite, and I think why they're moving so overtly and thereby creating a dialectic for and a potential for revolutionary movements to respond in an overt way, is that the handwriting is on the wall. The handwriting is on the wall for their oil. You know, the sort of apocalypse that they're sort of creating for us in terms of this so-called energy policies and so forth. The handwriting is on the wall in terms of people's sense of the conscience of our nation lying in prisons in the form of political prisoners and prisoners of war. Understanding that these prisons are warehouses of death and that they need to be dismantled. People understand that the reason there's a housing health crisis and so on is because of this $400 billion military budget. Which is eating away not only at the lives and hopes and of communities abroad through its imperialist ventures ongoing, but also sapping the lifeblood of so much of what this people here could be. I don't really have too much more to say. I mean, those of you familiar with my work can get it through me. If you want to learn more about, you know, the minutiae of U.S. Pentagon machinations vis-a-vis suppression of dissent. Suffice to say, particularly since Seattle, there's a real lot of activity within the Pentagon towards, as I said, declaring war or furthering their war on American citizenry. It's very particular. It's very specific. It's around civil disturbance suppression. They're talking about foreign, so-called foreign theaters as well, because they've begun to export Garden Plot, which is roughly 200-page plan, which is shuttled around the country. They're exporting it now to different stations around the globe in terms of dealing with civil disturbance. But the dangerous trend of the collapsing of the police as an entity, as an institutional entity, and the military. Which is the sign of authoritarian, totalitarian governments worldwide, historically has always been that way, is really what we need to look at. I think that from where I'm coming from, we have a Pentagon Incorporated. We have think tanks like the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Council on Foreign Relations, and anybody who does any kind of even peripheral looking at those entities. These are corporate think tanks with interlocks to various military individuals. They just switch back and forth. They're on the Joint Chiefs one day, and then they're on the board of these corporations the next. It's that kind of situation. We need to begin to deal directly with militarism in this country. We need to bring 1 million people to the Pentagon on July 4th and declare independence from this monster. Because what we're seeing in terms of the repression that's taking place now, that until we're able to stop the growth of this apparatus and the spread of it in terms of its ability through technology transfers. I mentioned this crowd dispersal weapon before. The Pentagon has been testing this for a number of years now. It heats skin to 130 degrees from 200 yards. And basically, in the 60s, we used to talk about eating the rich. Well, now they're talking about eating the protesters. So, I mean, it's a very serious development. They're getting ready to feel this thing. A group in Massachusetts has sued at the state level to block this weapon and has begun to create other kinds of suits there on the local police department level to look specifically, to delineate within agencies like the NYPD, where does this money come from, what kinds of funding is military related, what kind of contracts. The NYPD, for instance, has a contract with a group called Firearms Training Systems Incorporated, FATS, in its offshore subsidiary, was actually known as THIN, believe it or not, and is now Firearms Training Systems Incorporated, and has a contract with the NYPD and trains the NYPD in quick shoot reflex, okay, through video simulation. They also have contracts with the Marines. They also train most of the armed forces in different parts of the country. They're the largest video simulation arms trainer in the world. They have a contract with the NYPD. I don't think that's correct. I think we need to begin to get inside of these institutions. We have to implode them from within. We may not have the capability, short of clandestinity, to deal directly in that way, but there are ways through the creativity of people sitting in this room that we can begin to implode and dissolve these institutions from within. So we have to figure out those kinds of ways, whether it's through suits around forbidding certain kinds of contractual arrangements between police and the military, which are taking place. It's proliferating in terms of non-lethal weapons thing, which is a small arms boom. We can begin to put some blocks in that. But I think in the end, there is no easy solution to, well, what are we going to do about this repression coming down? What we're going to do is we're going to be bolder. Fortune favors the bold. I think some punk rock band once said that. And I really think it's true. I think that what we have to do is we have to educate, agitate, and organize and keep fighting and hopefully create more forums like this so we can begin to bring more and more people in touch with this kind of thing. Because what happens is that when we can dispel fear through struggle. We can dispel fear through being connected to one another. We can dispel these attempts to disunite us through gossip and slander and so forth and so on, to the extent that we know each other and we know what the deal is. And we can suss these people out. They have new technology and so forth. They have the guns, we have the numbers, and we just got to keep fighting. So I'm going to leave it there so we can kind of open up to discussion.
So we have the room for another hour, 15 minutes, so we can have question, answer, and discussion. And Dan's going to take staff. And for anybody who doesn't want voice recognition, because the tapes are still going to be running, but they won't be pointed at you, you can write down your question on a piece of paper, and one of us will read it out loud for you. So try to get his attention when you want to put your hand up and get on the staff to talk. Come on. Can you stand when you... Sorry, just because I'm sorry we didn't get a sound system worked out.
All right. I had a question for Frank. You mentioned that maybe two ways that we can go around this, like USA Patriot Act or USA Patriot Law, and the scrutiny that activists and people dissent is by horizontally organizing, going into communities, and also doing things in a clandestine manner where it's not transparent. But I think I'm curious, do you think that there's a tension between those two approaches? I think if we do things in a clandestine manner where it's not transparent, first, it might alienate like a broad-based support for what we're doing. It might drive our movement underground and only make a small group of people involved in the movement. And it might not get us the broad-based support that we might need from it, from these communities of homeless people, of squatters, of immigrants, and et cetera. I'm just curious if you could address that, or if you thought there was
tension. Well, I'm just kind of thinking out loud among friends and associates. I mean, it seems to me that the state is trying to drive people underground. That is, you know, part of their rationale for intimidation and repression and so on, is to do precisely that. So I'm not suggesting that we necessarily go along that way, and I'm not putting a value judgment on clandestine approaches to social struggle and so on. I was just suggesting that we need to move horizontally into the communities and build a base in the communities and not always deal vertically. In other words, these guys are going to have a meeting and we want to go to the pinnacle of the pyramid and to make our demands. That we can deal with people like the WAF and some of these other formations to the extent that we begin to move horizontally into the communities and dig roots. In other words, that kind of thing. As far as the other thing goes, I it's historically on record, so it's no need not to discuss it, but I was a supporter of around the Puerto Rican 11 who were arrested in 1980, who were members of the FALN, which were Puerto Rican freedom fighters who believed that in the right to struggle against the colonial situation in Puerto Rico through any means necessary, and became somewhat familiar with the politics of armed struggle and this kind of thing. Now, I'm not for a moment suggesting that that's what I was getting at, but what I'm talking about is that when we deal with the kind of apparatus that we're looking at, that it would be unwise for us to limit ourselves to the kinds of... I think that we need to keep all our options open. I think we need to look at... Clandestinity can apply to squatting. There were people who used to like to do squatting where you'd go and make a symbolic show that we were going to take this building if you don't meet our demands. Well, we weren't about that. We were about clandestinity. We'd take a building and maybe a year or two later the city would find out we were there. So there's a lot of places for clandestinity, setting up bases, setting up places that activists can freely discuss stuff, sharing information, ways in which to raise funds and so forth that are maybe not so easily traceable. I mean, there's a lot of things. Print shops. There's a lot of things that we need to do that we don't necessarily want to tip our hands about. That's all I was getting at. I don't mean to belabor it, but I think there may come a time, and I know there's a lot of feeling about this, when the oppressed in this country will have to pick up arms, okay? I think that there will be a time when certain segments of the population will be fed up to the extent that they'll begin to fight back with anything they can use. Our brothers and sisters around the world are involved in those kinds of struggles at this point. This is not something that I applaud or feel good about, but I just think it's reality given the kinds of repression that could be down the pike.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
Can I just make a comment about that? Wait, excuse me.
No. She wanted to respond also. One of our panelists wanted to respond. Thanks.
I want to get into that.
And we have a stack. So if you just want to get his attention, and then he'll put you on.
I just wanted to say I think that all successful resistance movements have operated at all possible levels, and that we have to, as you said, keep be aware of all the different options that are available, and at some point it becomes a matter of personal choice, of personal engagement, the level at which any particular person wants to become involved. But it's really, really important in the process of that not to buy into the dominant society's labeling of which options are acceptable and which aren't, because if we do that, we've lost the struggle to start with. Of course they're not going to give us options that actually give room for truly viable change. And to the extent that we see violence, that the state is the purveyor of violence under these circumstances, and to the extent that we see that people are resisting that or are defending themselves against that, just because some of us wouldn't necessarily engage in those particular tactics does not mean that we need to become agents of the state in condemning them either.
These political definitions that they're using all the time, like terrorists, and they're acquiring a legal standing in court. That translation from the FBI or whoever coming up with these definitions to translating into criminal charges, like this language has this effect in this process. All of a sudden, it's totally unconstitutional, but this language can isolate a group or an individual, and then they can do whatever they want to it. So this language really concerns me because it seems to should not apply to legal standing. And Frank, I just wanted to say, I like what you said about keeping options open.
Okay. Well, first, with a reference to the last part of what you asked, no, I wouldn't want to contextualize Freeh's case in that way because I'm not familiar enough with the context of Freeh's case to do it. Okay? I think that's what you asked me.
Yeah, I thought you knew about
it. I do, but not...
Maybe later.
It's, yeah.
He had a 23-year sentence. He's 22 years old for property destruction, essentially, but he was called the eco-terrorist. It kind of fits into what you're talking about.
And he's from Eugene, Oregon, and they got a joint terrorist task force working against them out in Eugene, and there's some very severe targeting that's going on there. But I'm not from Eugene, okay? And I don't want to speak to the context, the community context of that, or questions of leadership or so forth within that community because I'm not part of it. That's the nature of my response to that. I think we should be a little careful about using we in the context as sweeping as you just did. Some of us have leadership structures of necessity. Some of them inherited by tradition. Some of us do not. But ultimately, to do anything, we always have leaders. They may be situational at any given moment, but you will not instruct the plumber on how to fix your sink. He will be your leader, or she will be your leader. And I'm not, you asked a question. I'm responding to the question. Then we will debate the question, okay? There's different ways that leadership functions, okay? But it is always asserted, even if simply in an exemplary manner. Somebody going out and doing something all on their own, and other people emulate, they take clues, they shape their consciousness according to that example, and proceed according to their own lights. That is nonetheless a leadership posture. We are way too slick at postulating things that are demonstrably naturally impossible and imposing them on everybody in sight as a principle of some kind of political purity, and that is a dysfunctional approach. Now, how it worked in Eugene, I don't know. Okay? What the specific implications of the leadership or non-leadership dynamic that's involved in that community and how that plays into this particular individual getting this draconian sentence, I couldn't say. It's the draconian sentence that's an issue in my mind. That you got somebody, well, you've got, this is not the only individual from that particular community. You've got a guy named Rob Taxon out there who's doing 7 years for throwing a rock. We want to talk about the response of the Israelis to the Intifada. You look at it in Eugene, Oregon, and see exactly the same thing. And this is maximum security prison time, and it is for throwing one rock at one cop. Didn't even hit the guy, as far as I know. Okay? The particular case she's talking about, and I think his name is Lure, yes? Yeah. It's for torching an SUV or a row of SUVs is a statement about the
global warming.
Well, according to what he told me, it had to do with people using forest land as recreation area as well. In any event, he had a particular set of reasons for doing that, and the upshot is 23-year sentence ultimately for burning a recreational vehicle. So we're talking real serious stakes to the game out there. But the issues as to how to structure their response and how to structure the continuation of action arises from that community, not from Ward Churchill sitting in New York talking to a bunch of people who have a completely different set of circumstances to deal with, you understand? That's the best response I can give you.
To me, that just illustrates the fallacy of accepting the legal definitions of what is criminal. Right. I mean, that's what the point you're making illustrates that anything can be made into a crime, and many, many things are made into crimes, and we have to be very careful about, I mean, on the one hand, understanding what the current enforcement is, but not at the same time accepting that the definition of, for example, now there's a tendency to distinguish between, you know, sort of social protest crimes, which we might not believe are legitimately criminalized, and you know, drugs, say. But if you look at the history of the drug war, you know, the way it has been used has been exactly to oppressed poor communities that would otherwise perhaps be more politically challenging to the status quo. And so to me it illustrates that we just have to be real careful about accepting those definitions and going along with them.
I guess the question is, how do we challenge them in court where it's just subject to your own protection?
Well, I mean, certainly you can raise constitutional challenges to them, but at this point, given the current Supreme Court, you know, that's a necessary vehicle. But the law, for the most part, you know, is designed primarily to support the status quo. And so we can use the law as a shield, but it's not necessarily our best sword. And, you know, we can bring those kinds of challenges or the kinds of cases you were talking about, but they're only successful if there is broad-based education and political movement around them. Then they can become the hook for, you know, actually getting something changed. But it's not
situation of how do we respond around all these possible threats.
I'm going to say you're the lawyer.
Okay. Well, I mean, mostly, we still, at least in theory, have Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment protections. And, you know, my strong advice would be don't talk. You know, talk only, tell them you want, you know, tell them you'll be happy to talk to them with your lawyer. Would they like to make an appointment? And, you know, particularly don't talk on the phone and don't talk without witnesses because you just don't know how anything will be characterized later. If you're not a citizen, it is, I mean, apparently they are exercising the arbitrary ability to detain non-citizens indefinitely with no exercise of rights. Again, I would, you know, to the extent possible, I would insist upon, you know, politely, but nonetheless clearly say, you know, I will be happy to talk to you with my lawyer, you know. Or, you know, my lawyer has said I shouldn't talk to you, but she'll be glad to come with me and talk to you. You know, but it doesn't, I've never seen any cases in, I've seen lots of instances in which people, particularly who are immigrants, who really believe in playing by the rules and believe everybody else plays by the rules, I have not seen much good come out of they're playing by the rules, and I've seen lots of instances in which the other side doesn't play by the rules, and I think that that's just sort of what we have to communicate, is that just because you haven't done anything and just because you don't know anything doesn't mean that, you know, talking is necessarily the best approach.
I think that historically we've all seen paranoia really destroy a lot of movements and individuals, not only in America, but all over, even in more severe ways than in America. So my question is that how do we avoid this paranoia that, in my opinion, is almost one of the government's strongest weapons against us while still maintaining a secure security culture?
Is that to address to anybody in particular?
Okay.
Paranoia is actually an operational technique. There was a memoranda, internal memoranda, that was put out by the FBI along about 1969, maybe early 1970. It said one object of their operations vis-a-vis the New Left at the time was to convince activists that there was, figuratively at least, an agent behind every mailbox. Which, of course, there couldn't be, but if they could con people into this. And that was part of the rumor mongering and a sowing of distrust between people within the groups and so forth, okay, to create a context in which people would become dysfunctional in terms of being their ability to engage in political activity. That doesn't seem to be a particularly effective method in a lot of contexts outside the United States. And I think that goes to a weird kind of, I guess American exceptionalism is the only thing I can call it. The right wing has this notion, you know, we're all familiar with that, that there's a set of rules for the rest of the world, and then there's a separate set of rules for the United States. The left mirrors that. We profess solidarity with movements who accept a set of governing principles of their struggle that are absolutely unacceptable to your average activist in the United States. We're exempt from the stakes of contestation there, and we take that to be a natural situation. So we got our left-wing American exceptionalism. And paranoia functions when people have a presumed entitlement to safety at some level while engaging in political oppositional work. And that is a sensibility that's absolutely absent just about every place else. Mm-hmm. It's a signifier of privilege.
My question has to do with what I think might be an antidote to paranoia, as that is good information. And my question, I guess, is about twofold. One deals with immigration and international networks. And I think yesterday and today have been, a couple days ago, there have been raids on independent media centers in Italy. A guy from Canadian Anti-Poverty Organization was stopped on the Michigan border. He was coming to address some students at Michigan State. He was sent back after 5 hours of interrogation by some State Department guy who was brought in from Detroit. And this guy Tomlinson, who's ex-MI6, who wrote this book called The Big Breach and has gotten a lot of slack from it. He was sued by the British government and all this stuff. I'm wondering whether good information that is possibly coming out of, you know, this cross-border solidarity, these lectures, the network of independent media centers, might be an antidote for paranoia if it was done well. I mean, if the claims that are made to mobilize people are well documented and compelling, therefore. And my second part of the question sort of illustrates, I think, what might be an example of that information, which is the rumor of 4,000 Jews being in the world, you know, being told that the World Trade Center, you know, was going to happen, and they didn't come into work that day on September 11th. And I guess, can you speak about information, outreach with information, how to protect those networks, how maybe Natsu Saiko could speak about how these people who are coming to lecture here, like Tomlinson was, and like this guy John Clark was, the legal implications of this boundary and it being policed and seeming to have a First Amendment right to like share information, but at the same time having it be subverted internationally. And maybe some more suggestions about documenting our sources when we make claims, because I know there's a lot of misinformation that subsequently undermines claims for solidarity and support and movements. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, this certainly fits the examples you gave of them stopping people at the border. We also have an extremely long history of that. The courts have consistently said that the Justice Department, which of course is in charge of the INS, has, and the State Department, have the ability to stop people from coming in. They have, you know, the courts have refused to intervene in this process, and basically they've said that anybody who is not a U.S. citizen who is trying to come in has no constitutional rights, and we who are here have no constitutional rights to have them come in. And so, you know, that unfortunately in that area the law is very, very clear, and I think that to me that's part of a bigger problem. It's something we call the plenary power doctrine in immigration law, which is also which basically says the courts won't stop Congress or the executive from doing anything they want. There's no constitutional protections with respect to immigration law. It's also the doctrine that they use to completely perpetuate their genocidal policies against Indian nations and against U.S. territories like Puerto Rico. And part of the problem is that the rest of us have sat around and said, that's foreigners, that's other people, that's, you know, somebody else, and we've allowed this incredible body of law to develop that says the government can do anything they damn well please in that area. And so, you know, as a lawyer, I hate to say it, but, you know, the law is not on our side in these cases.
I want to tell you something else to that, because there's another area where plenary authority functions. And plenary authority is extra-constitutional, okay? Those constitutional rights and protections and all the rest of that stuff do not apply to people in immigrant categories, colonial categories, or American Indians in the conventional sense. But it also doesn't apply to you. At times of national emergency, okay, there's a declarative... There's a presumption, constitutional authorization to go outside the Constitution with the invocation of martial law. Okay? Your normal constitutional rights and protections are suspended arbitrarily for the duration, and the executive makes a determination as to that duration. Well, they didn't do that exactly. What they did was construct something called a national security state, where they're doing exactly that on an incremental basis, and they've been doing it for a long time. And the upshot, Felix Cohen once made an analogy of American Indians to the miner's canary, because what it was that was done to Indians socially, politically, and otherwise, he said, was simply a preview of what it was that was coming down the pike for everybody else. So people might ought to pay attention. Nobody much did, because it was only Indians it was happening to. And it was only unnaturalized aliens who were put on that boat down at the docks in 1919 and shipped to Russia. And it's only unnaturalized and possibly terrorist-affiliated aliens that are being held in the internment centers now, and it was only the Japanese that were put under plenary authority, and although two-thirds of them were citizens, incarcerated for as long as the executive wanted to during the Second World War, and it was only, and it was only, and it was only, and all of that just adds up to an incremental elimination of the very things y'all take for granted when you're debating law, because ultimately, under a condition of perpetual martial law, you got none of those rights, and it's constitutionally authorized nullification of the Constitution. Okay? And you got people basically applauding for their own well-being, their placement of themselves in exactly the position of the people that they're saying should be placed in those positions in order to protect them from what? The danger is in the government. The danger is in the state. The danger is in this increasingly arbitrary exercise of authority that everybody's willing to applaud as long as it's happening to somebody else, but ultimately there aren't any somebody else's left. It's everybody that's being targeted. Huey P. Newton once said that politics, and I assume everybody here considers themselves a political being in some sense or another. Huey put it this way: politics is a very simple thing, very complicated to effectuate, but very simple to understand. It is simply the ability to define a phenomena and cause it to act in a desired manner. Well, we're defining a phenomena, and a phenomena is not something you can reason with, that you can appeal to logic, moral high ground, and all the rest of that. Petition campaigns aren't going to do it. Candlelit vigils aren't going to do it. Singing the right songs aren't going to do it. Dietary changes aren't going to do it. Changing your clothing style isn't going to fix things, okay? There is not a pill you can take. This is a lethal entity that is bound and determined to harness you to the wheel of its power prerogatives, okay? Recognize it for what it is, and your position ultimately is not going to be any different from the people who are most oppressed. Take the people who are most oppressed and their response patterns of necessity as your indicator of what is appropriate, and get on with it.
Right on.
Okay?
Men right now, we only have two women on. You're up, and then we've got one.